Well, good afternoon, everyone. Hope everyone's having a positive Sabbath wherever you're seeing this message, whether it's off the live broadcast or off of, you know, the internet or off a DVD after the fact. Well, brethren, I think as we all know, as New Covenant Christians, we're called to come out of the world that we're living in. In other words, I mean, to kind of give it a physical analogy, we're kind of called to be salmon swimming upstream. In other words, you know, the culture and the world around us is all flowing in one direction, and we're called to be oddballs. You know, we're called to basically buck that and to go a completely different way and to follow God and to kind of fight the current, you might say, you know, where all the force of, you know, the energy is coming in one direction at you, but you have to willfully decide to go the opposite direction and to kind of be a loner and go it alone and follow God in spite of, you know, all the pressures of the world around us that are trying to pull us in the opposite direction. You know, that's kind of inherent to being a New Covenant Christian and something we're all, you know, at least, you know, relatively familiar with. But if we look at the history of God's people, I mean, even going back to ancient Israel, you know, in their physical relationship with God all the way to the New Covenant Church, mankind, unfortunately, has a very consistent track record of wanting to follow the herd, you know, of wanting to follow a man, you know, a particular leader, or to follow the group and just kind of go along with the herd of the people that they're in whatever direction that is, rather than following God. And oftentimes, you know, what we'll see throughout this sermon is that has a consistent track record of getting mankind in trouble, of getting us off in the wrong direction, because we just, our inherent physical nature is we want to follow men or follow the crowd around us rather than choosing to follow God and to be independent and follow Him. And one of the reasons for that is that it requires faith to follow God. This is one of the reasons why the Bible tells us that the just must live by faith, that without faith it's impossible to please God. It's because we have to have that faith in believing and following Him, again, in spite of all of the natural physical pulls around us. We have to, again, be that salmon wanting to swim upstream and fighting against the current, which is just, you know, the opposite of our nature. So we want to look at this particular subject today because, again, it's something inherently important to us as New Covenant Christians because, again, we have to be willing to go it alone and to kind of fight the natural current of the stream, you might say. So if you'd like a title for this sermon, it's Having the Faith to Follow God. Again, having the faith to follow God. Because as we're going to see through this, our natural tendency as physical human beings is to follow the culture around us, to go along with the herd, to follow a particular physical leader, to do anything but following God. You know, that is our natural tendency. So let's start off just taking a brief look at the definition of faith. We'll go exactly where you would kind of expect, to Hebrews chapter 11. Hebrews chapter 11, and we'll see here again the statement that, you know, to follow and to please God, we simply have to have faith. It's a fundamental requirement. We can't do it without it. And as we'll see here, even when the very definition of faith is against how our physical minds tend to work, you know, we tend to grasp onto what we can physically relate to in our physical world, what we can see, what we can perceive with our physical senses, what makes sense to our physical minds. Well, faith is the exact opposite of all of that. It's Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 1. Now faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. For by it the elders obtained a good testimony. By faith we understand that the worlds were framed by the word of God, so that the things which are seen are not made by things which are visible. Again, our world is we tend to go with our empirical senses, what we can see, what we can feel, what makes sense to our physical minds. Well, faith is completely outside of that. And skip down to verse 6. But without faith it is impossible to please Him. For he who comes to God must believe that He is, and He is the rewarder of those who diligently seek Him. In other words, we must have a complete faith and trust in God that He's going to take care of us, you know, regardless of what our physical senses are telling us. You know, regardless of the physical circumstances that we're facing in our world, we have to depend and rely upon God because, again, we have to be that salmon swimming upstream. We've got to be going against, you know, the current and kind of where the direction where the herd is wanting to go, we have to be in to think individually and to want to follow him in spite of all of that. Well, again, if you look at the history of God's people, I mean, going back again to the beginning with ancient Israel, you know, all throughout even the New Covenant Church, what we'll find is unfortunately this human tendency that human beings would rather follow a strong physical leader or follow the group that they're in rather than following God. And this goes all the way back to Mount Sinai. It's the tendency of mankind throughout our entire history. So turn over to Exodus chapter 20. Exodus chapter 20, we'll see the very account at Mount Sinai, where God is, you know, delivering the commandments there to make a covenant with ancient Israel. And I think it's interesting to also see up to this point, by the time they've gotten to this point, you know, to Mount Sinai, remember, they've already experienced, you know, all the plagues upon the Egyptians. They've seen the Red Sea parted. You know, they're now being fed by food that falls from the sky 6 days a week. You know, they're seeing lots of evidence of the supernatural God that's working with them. And they also get the advantage of something that we don't get today. You know, today typically, you know, when we communicate with God, we pray to him, you know, we talk directly to him, but we don't hear a voice talking back to us. You know, we have to study his word and, you know, and play, and he inspires our thoughts and such, but we don't get the benefit of a conversation where you actually hear God speaking and telling you his will. Well, they actually got to hear God's voice and they didn't want to hear it. You know, and we'll just notice here in Exodus chapter 20 and verse 18. This is after he's, you know, thundered out the Ten Commandments from Mount Sinai. It says, now all the people witnessed the thunderings, the lightnings, flashes, the sound of the trumpet, the mountain smoking. When the people saw it, they trembled and stood afar off. Then they said to Moses, you speak with us and we will hear. But let not God speak with us, lest we die. And Moses said to the people, do not fear, for God has come to test you, that his fear may be before you, so that you may not sin. So the people stood afar off, but Moses drew near the thick darkness where God was. You know, how many times in our lives have we been through a difficult situation? Like, I wish God would just come and, you know, just tell me his will. You know, I just hear a voice and just tell me exactly what to do. You know, I'm sure you've thought that at some point in your life. I certainly have. You know, well, they literally have the Creator God directly speaking, and they get to hear his voice, you know, telling them what they should do. And they're like, that's too scary. You know, we don't want to hear directly from God. You know, we just rather follow a man. In other words, Moses, you just tell us what God wants and we'll just follow you, because dealing directly with God, that's too scary. That's too uncomfortable. We just rather follow a physical man. That has been the history of mankind, you know, from Mount Sinai up to today. Even, you know, in the modern day Church of God, more often than not, people want to follow a man. They want a man to tell them, you know, what to do. They want just their group to tell them exactly how they should behave and not have a personal relationship with God. That's been a weakness of mankind from the very beginning. And that always gets us into trouble. Because notice what happens here, even after they make this covenant. Now, they have experienced, again, all these miracles. They have seen that the Red Sea parted. They have experienced the plagues upon the Egyptians, seen all this supernatural intervention. They're getting food is falling from the sky 6 days a week. I mean, every time they eat, they're witnessing the miracle that God is present and taking care of them. But what happens when their physical leader is gone longer than they expect him to be? They immediately lose faith because they're looking to a physical man. They're not looking to God. And we can see this in Exodus 32. This is the famous golden calf incident. But notice what happens here. And again, I think it's important to remember at this point, even though Moses disappears longer than they're expecting him to be gone, food is still falling from the sky 6 days a week. You know, if they're just paying attention to what's going on around them, God hasn't gone anywhere. But notice their reaction. Exodus 32 and verse 1. Now, when the people saw that Moses delayed coming down from the mountain, the people gathered together to Aaron and said to him, "Come make us gods that shall go before us. For as for this Moses, the man who brought us out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him." Now they watch again, the Red Sea being parted. They've seen all these supernatural miracles, and they still haven't grasped it. Moses wasn't the voice thundering from the mountain. You know, Moses was the guy you said, "No, we don't want to hear the voice from the mountain. You just talk to God and you just tell us." See, they're looking to a man. They're following a man. God's not even in their thought process. In verse 2, "And Aaron said to them, 'Break off the golden earrings which are in your ears of your wives, your sons, your daughters, and bring them to me.' So all the people broke off the golden earrings which are in their ears and brought them to Aaron. And he received the gold from their hand, and he fashioned it with the engraving tool and made a molded calf. And then they said, 'This is your God, O Israel, who brought you out of the land of Egypt.' So when Aaron saw it, he built an altar before it. And Aaron made a proclamation and said, 'Tomorrow is the feast unto Jehovah.'" And notice here, they immediately went back into idolatry. But notice also what Aaron is doing. He goes along with this too, but he's trying to put a good face on it. So he makes up basically a fake holy day now. You know, so we're going to have a feast unto Jehovah, even though he knows the calf, that's not Jehovah. You know, this is an image that we just got told a few chapters ago specifically not to do. You know, to make images and to lay down, you know, and to bow down before them. You know, so again, their whole focus here, they're not seeing God. You know, they're just wanting to follow a man, follow a culture, you know, around them. God is not really in the picture. And see, this has been the history of mankind, you know, from this point all the way forward. Because you'll see this throughout the history of ancient Israel. You know, as a general rule, you know, they had, as we know, a long history of always going astray and always rebelling. But you'll see a general trend. When they had a strong leader, you know, who was trying to lead them in the right direction towards God, they would generally kind of behave for the most part for a while. And then if that leader died or, you know, went astray, you know, then very quickly afterwards, they all abandon that and then go astray and go after other gods. You know, so but basically the absence of a strong leader or just having an evil leader, they always wind up following kind of the direction of where their leader is and where the culture is. And you can see as a result of this, they're not following God. They're following a man. They're following the culture around them. They're just kind of going along with the herd. It's not an issue of having faith in God and being willing to stay faithful to him in spite of what's going on around them. If you'll turn over to the book of Judges here, we'll kind of see this summarized here. It's in Judges chapter 2. Judges chapter 2 in verse 7. "So the people served Jehovah all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua, who had seen all the great works of Jehovah, which he had done for Israel. Now Joshua, the son of Nun, the servant of Jehovah, died when he was 110 years old. And they buried him within the border of the inheritance of Timnath-Heres in the mountain of Ephraim on the north side of Mount Gash. And when all the generation had been gathered to their fathers, another generation arose after them that did not know Jehovah, nor the works which he had done for Israel. Then the children of Israel did evil in the sight of Jehovah and served the Baals. And they forsook Jehovah, the God of their fathers, who had brought them out of the land of Egypt. And they followed other gods from among the gods of the people who were all around them. And they bowed down to them, and they provoked Jehovah to anger. And they forsook Jehovah and served Baal and the Ashtaroths. And the anger of Jehovah was hot against Israel. So they delivered them in the hands of plunderers who despoiled them. And he sold them into the hands of their enemies all around, so they could no longer stand before their enemies. Wherever they went out, the hand of Jehovah was against them for calamity, as Jehovah had said, and as the Jehovah had sworn to them, and they were greatly distressed. And then Jehovah raised up the judges who delivered them out of the hand of those who plundered them. Yet they would not listen to their judges, and they played the harlot with other gods, and bowed down to them, and they turned quickly from the way in which their fathers walked. In obeying the commandments of Jehovah, they did not do so. And when Jehovah raised up judges for them, then Jehovah was with the judge and delivered them out of the hand of the enemies of the days of the judge. For Jehovah was moved to pity by their groaning because of those who oppressed them and harassed them. And it came to pass, when the judge was dead, that they reverted and behaved more corruptly than their fathers, by following other gods to serve them and to bow down to them. And they did not cease from their own doings, nor from their stubborn ways. And notice again that trend. When they had a righteous leader trying to lead them in the right direction, they tended to kind of behave for a while. But what would happen as soon as that leader is removed from their life, what happens? They immediately start, you know, going after other gods, abandoning everything that they've believed in, because again, they're not through faith having a relationship with God. They're just playing follow the leader. You know, the game you play as children, you know, you kind of follow the leader and do what Simon says type thing. That's basically what they're doing. They're just kind of following along with a strong leader or with the culture around them. And when the peer pressure is, you might say, kind of going in a positive direction, they kind of go along with the herd in that direction. And then when the peer pressure turns negative, they follow along with that. You know, and they're just kind of herd animals, not really, you know, having that character then to follow God and to be a salmon swimming upstream, you know, to have the character to endure and to obey Him regardless of what's taking place, you know, around them, because that's having a personal relationship with God, and that's not what's happening here. You know, these people are just doing the typical human thing of following the crowd and following the leader. And in verse 20, then the anger of Jehovah was hot against Israel, and he said, because this nation has transgressed my covenant which I commanded their fathers, and has not heeded my voice, I will no longer drive out before them any of the nations which Joshua left when he died, so that through them I may test Israel, whether they will keep the ways of Jehovah to walk in them as their fathers kept them or not. Therefore, Jehovah left those nations without driving them out immediately, nor did he deliver them into the hands of Joshua. As you can see here, he purposely allowed them these situations to test them, to test their character. You know, he does the same thing with us. He allows tests and trials in our lives, in difficult situations for us to face, because again, he wants to test our loyalty. You know, because again, if he leaves, you know, if you just look back in the history of the Church of God in our lifetimes, you know, I know when I was a teenager, you know, we were all in one big organization, and you kind of had this perception of, oh, it's one big happy family, and we're all kind of moving along, and you think everybody's kind of on the same page. Well, what happened? Well, then our primary leader died, you know, and the people that came along running the organization after that pretty much abandoned, you know, everything the church believed in. And over time, what you saw was the majority of the church basically just walking away from what all these people said they believed in for years of their lives. I mean, for decades, you know, people had gone along saying they sincerely believed these things and, you know, would follow this for the rest of their lives. But as soon as, you know, their leader and the organization, kind of the peer pressure around them, you know, started going in a different direction, what do? Follow the herd. You know, go along for just following a man, you know, and that doesn't work for us as Christians. We have to have a direct relationship with God. But we have to remember that God, you know, allows these things to happen to test us, to try our character, to see, do we really have a relationship with Him? Or again, are we just being herd animals and just kind of going along, following the crowd, doing what everybody else is doing and doing what's comfortable? You know, what kind of our habit? You know, what? Sometimes He has to stir things up and test us and try us to see, You know, what are we made of? What are we going to do? And this is exactly what he did with Israel. Just continue on now in chapter 3. Now these are the nations which Jehovah left, that he might test Israel by them. That is, all who had known any of who had not known any of the wars in Canaan. And this was only so that the generations of the children of Israel might be taught to know war, at least those who had not formerly known it. Namely, the five lords of the Philistines, all the Canaanites, the Sidonians, the Hivites, who dwelt in Mount Lebanon, from Mount Baal Hermon and the entrance of Hamath. And they were left that he might test Israel by them, to know where they would obey the commandments of Jehovah, which he had commanded their fathers by the hand of Moses. So the children of Israel dwelt among the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. And they took their daughters to be their wives, gave their daughters to be their sons, and they served their gods. So he purposely allowed these situations to test their character, to see, are they going to, you know, follow along with anything that they agreed to? They made a covenant with God that they would, you know, faithfully obey him and follow his commandments in return for, you know, for the blessings they would receive. But typical of human nature, yeah, they wanted to receive the blessings and the, you know, the nice land to live in and all the good weather and all the nice physical blessings, but faithfully obeying, they didn't want to really stick with that, you know. And what did they do? They typically just wanted to go along with whatever felt good today, you know, whatever's comfortable, kind of go along with the herd and just fit in with the crowd, because that's human nature. You know, what we tend to do is, again, to follow the leader or just kind of follow the peer pressure around us and what the group is doing, rather than saying, no, I personally made a commitment to follow God. And if that means I have to stand alone and do it by myself, you know, and I'm the only one, well, then that's what I'll do, because that's the covenant that I made. And that's what we have to remember. You know, when we all made a covenant with God, we promised that we would faithfully obey regardless of what everyone else does. You know, and we have to be willing to do that. And later in this sermon, we'll look at examples of, you know, some of the faithful servants of God who had to do that. But realize this history of, you know, wanting to follow the leader, to follow a man, you know, or just follow what your group is doing, that type of thing. It wasn't just something that ancient Israel fell into. I mean, you know, it's very understandable to look back, if you understand just the subject of faith, as to why ancient Israel would have this proclivity, you know, for always going astray and just kind of following the herd, you know, not individually following God. Because a fundamental key, as we read when we started this sermon in Hebrews 11, is faith is the fundamental component to being able to follow God. Well, this was the people who didn't have access to the Holy Spirit, you know, and the ability through of faith through the Holy Spirit to do that. So, you know, they're kind of set up to fail in a sense. You know, they're fighting a spiritual battle. They've got the pull of Satan against them. They don't have the spiritual armor to be able to fight that battle. So they kind of brought a knife to a gunfight, and we should kind of expect them to lose, you know. But we also need to realize that the New Covenant Church had some of these same proclivities as well of falling into wanting to follow a man and not follow God and have an individual relationship. If you look, turn over to 1 Corinthians, we'll see Paul addressing this with the Corinthian church. Because we can see he's kind of addressing, so you might say, some of the symptoms of this problem, but it gets down to the same heart of the same issue. You know, because as we saw with ancient Israel, their proclivity is, you know, they had a good leader, well, then they would, you know, they'd look to that leader, you know, and they'd behave for a while if the leader was kind of leading them in the right direction. And if they had an evil leader or you know, kind of a lack of a good leadership, well, then they immediately went astray. You know, and we even saw that, you know, they were following Moses at Mount Sinai. Well, Moses is gone for a little while. They immediately forget about God, and their whole focus is, well, we don't know what happened to Moses, so now we need to make idols. Even though food's still falling from the sky 6 days a week, you know, there's still evidence that the God that they've made a covenant with hasn't gone anywhere. You know, he's still there and being faithful, but they're not focused on that. What we'll see here is one of the things that Paul is chastising the Corinthian church for is they're fighting over their physical leaders. You know, they're fighting over who's the most righteous based upon who their physical leader is. The whole point he's trying to get them to see is, you've lost God in the whole picture. You know, you didn't get baptized in the name of these, you know, these physical leaders. You know, this is about God and Christ, and you should be focused on them. And if you were focused on them, these squabbles you've got about who your leader is, this wouldn't even be your focus. So notice here in 1 Corinthians 1, in verse 10. Now I plead with you, brethren, by the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that you all speak the same thing, and that there be no divisions among you, but that you be perfectly joined together in the same mind and in the same judgment. For it has been declared to me concerning you, my brethren, by those of Chloe's house, that there are contentions among you. Now I say this, that each of you says, I am of Paul, I am of Paulus, I am of Cephas, or I am of Christ. Is Christ divided? Was Paul crucified for you? Or were you baptized in the name of Paul? I thank God that I baptized none of you except Crispus, Gaius, lest anyone should say that I had baptized in my own name. Yes, I was baptized in the household of Stephanas. I also baptized the household of Stephanas. Besides, I do not know whether I baptized any other. For Christ did not send me to baptize, but to preach the gospel, not with the wisdom of words, lest the cross of Christ should be made of no effect. Notice he's pointing out to them, the squabbles you guys are going on as to who's greater, this is all about physical men. This is all, I mean, if you put it in a modern day context, you know, today we don't argue, you know, with, is it Paul or Peter or Apollos, you know, we put in Church of God organizational names. It's the same argument, though. And it comes from the same carnal mindset of, you know, well, my group, God only works through this group, or we're the best group, our group's better than that group, you know, and it's the same squabble. It's a whole focus on physical men and physical organization, and God's not even in the picture. And he addresses this again over in 1 Corinthians chapter 3. Turn over to 1 Corinthians 3. Let's pick up in verse 1. And I, brethren, could not speak to you as to spiritual people, but as to carnal, as to babes in Christ. I fed you with milk and not with solid food. For until now you were not able to receive it, and even now you are still not able, for you are still carnal. For where there are envy, strife, and divisions among you, are you not carnal and behaving like mere men? For when one says, I am of Paul, and another, I am of Apollos, are you not carnal? What's interesting to me about this is if you listen to some of those who get into these squabbles in the modern day Church of God, you know, in the way that it'll play out, it won't typically be individual names. It'll be, well, God only works through this particular group. And if you ask, well, why is that? Well, we're the spiritual giants, you know. We're the tip of the spear. We're the Philadelphians, and everybody else is the Laodiceans. We're the most righteous in all this. And the humorous part of this is if you just take note of what Paul is saying here, by virtue of the fact that one is making that argument, immediately disqualifies them from being the spiritual giant. You know, because the argument is always, we're the most godly, and we're the most led by the Spirit and everything like this. And as Paul's saying, if you were really led by the Spirit, you wouldn't be making this argument. You know, you wouldn't be so carnal as to even be engaging in this if your mind was truly on God and Christ and on the fruits of the Spirit. You wouldn't be going down this silly road at all. You know, because as he goes down to explain in the rest of this chapter, as we're about to read here, he's pointing out to them, you know, God's not even in the picture with you. You've totally missed the picture of what he's doing, because you're focused on men and organizations and you're not focused on God. Pick up here in verse 5. Who then is Paul and who is Apollos? But ministers through whom you believed, as the Lord gave to each one. I planted, Apollos watered, but God gave the increase. So then neither he who plants is anything, nor he who waters, but God who gives the increase. Now he who plants and he who waters are one, and each one will receive his own reward according to his own labor. For we are God's fellow workers, and you are God's field. You are God's building. According to the grace of God, which is given to me as a wise master builder, I have laid the foundation and another builds on it. But let each one take heed how he builds on it. For no other foundation can anyone lay than that which is laid, which is Jesus Christ. Now, if anyone builds on this foundation with gold, silver, and precious stone, wood, hay, and straw, each one's work will become manifest in the day will declare it, because it will be revealed by fire, and fire will test each one's work of what sort it is. If anyone's work will be built on it, it endures, and he will receive a reward. If anyone's work is burned, he will suffer loss, and he himself will be saved, so as to through fire. And do not know that you are the temple of God, and that the Spirit of God dwells in you? If anyone defiles the temple of God, he will destroy him, for the temple of God is holy, and the temple you are. And notice when he talks about how basically fire will prove what's enduring and what's not. He's talking about being tried by fire. In other words, being put through very difficult situations where it's painful, it's difficult, and we have to strive to endure through it, you know, because it hurts and it tests our character. That proves who's really following God. You know, it's easy, just like I said, when I mentioned, like, when I was a teenager growing up in the church, you know, we all kind of feel like we're on one big happy family. You know, when you're all in this one big organization and you kind of think that, well, everybody's on the same page, and you know, you have all this structure around you and have all your friends. I had my local YOU group, and you know, you had all these other activities going on, and you're just kind of a part of this culture. And you think, well, everybody's on the same page. Well, then later everything changed and this all kind of busts apart, and then the culture, you know, that you're used to kind of following along totally abandons everything that you believed in. Well, then we start seeing who really, you know, sincerely believed what we all profess to believe, and who was just kind of going along with the herd and just going along with the crowd. Because what did we see over time? The majority of people basically walked away from everything they'd ever believed in. You know, they either wound up back in Protestant churches or just completely gave up on the concept of following God entirely. You know, and this was after decades of, you know, living what they said they believed, you know, and then you realized, okay, it sounds more like they had a relationship with a culture, with an organization, with kind of, you know, just the peer pressure and the structure around them, and then kind of their social group, than they really had with God. Because if we really have a relationship with God, you know, you can take away the social structure, you can take away your strong leader, you can take away all that, and we still look to God. And we'll still want to obey and still want to follow God, even when it's painful, even if we're all by ourselves, even if it's just us and God, and we have to forge and, you know, survive through that, we'll be willing to do that if we're really looking to God. Because see, it's mankind's, our inherent nature is we tend to kind of respond to the peer pressure. Again, if the peer pressure is going in a positive direction and everybody's seeming to want to obey God, that's the popular thing to do. Well, you know, we'll be part of the herd and kind of play along, you know. Well, then if the peer pressure is going in the other way, it tends to have the opposite effect. And see, this happened, you know, in Christ's time. There were people that knew he was the Messiah, who clearly understood. It wasn't like they were deceived and confused and didn't know what the truth was. They knew he was the Messiah. But if they would have known that, they would have been unpopular and been ostracized by their social group if they had professed the truth. And it literally became a salvational issue. Now, turn over to John chapter 12. John chapter 12 and verse 42. Nevertheless, even among the rulers, many believed in him. But because of the Pharisees, they did not confess him, lest they should be put out of the synagogue. For they love the praise of men more than the praise of God. So again, you can see what was important to them. Because they understood the truth. You know, this is telling us that they understood who Christ was. They know he's the promised Messiah. They're not confused about that. but they know if they profess this and they act accordingly, they're going to quickly become unpopular. And that's going to become painful. you know, and they're not willing to face the pain. You know, they're not willing to strike out on their own and be the salmon, you know, kind of swimming upstream and face the social pressure, say, you know, face the ostracization, you know, for following what they know is correct, because they don't want to face that kind of pain. They want to fit in. They want to be a herd animal and kind of go along with the crowd. And that's just, again, inherent to our carnal human nature. But to be faithful Christians, we have to be willing, you know, to go against that. You know, and we have to realize, as Christians, we have to be willing, you know, to basically forsake our social crowd. You know, again, if it comes down to a clear, you know, question between following God and fitting in with the crowd around us, you know, or hanging on to the, you know, to the favor of people that we care about versus God, we've got to pick God over everyone else in our lives. And this is a fundamental thing that we all had to look at before we even got baptized. I mean, if you got proper, you know, pre-baptismal counseling, I'm sure you probably went over Luke chapter 14. Let's turn over there to Luke chapter 14. And we'll see here that, you know, directly tells us we've got to be willing to place God above everything else in our lives. And again, that oftentimes can mean being a salmon, you know, having to swim upstream, having to go against everything else in our lives. And again, that may be being ostracized, that may be being kicked out of the synagogue, you know, as we just, you know, read in John chapter 12. And if that's what it means, that's what we've got to be willing to face. It's in Luke chapter 14 and verse 25. And great multitudes went with him, and he turned and said to them, "If anyone comes to me and does not hate his father, mother, wife, children, brothers and sisters, yes, his own life, he cannot be my disciple. And whoever does not bear his cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. For which of you, intending to build a tower, does not sit down first and count the cost, whether he has enough to finish it? Lest after he has laid the foundation and is not able to finish it, all who see it will begin to mock him, saying, 'This man began to build and was not able to finish.' Or what king, going to make war against another king, does not sit down first and consider whether he is able with 10,000 to meet him who comes against him with 20,000? Or else, while the other is still a great way off, he sends a delegation and asks conditions of peace. So likewise, whoever does not forsake all that he has cannot be my disciple." So we can see a fundamental requirement to be a New Covenant Christian is we have to be willing to, you know, again, to strike out on our own, to be independent if that's what it's, you know, what's required. And again, not just go along with the herd, not just follow a particular leader, be a part of a particular group, but do what we know is right, you know, what we've studied in our own Bible. And again, if that means being unpopular, you know, if that means being ostracized, well, that's the cross we have to bear. You know, that's what's required of us as Christians. And see, this is why faith is so important. Because it takes faith and that trust and reliance on God to endure through this, you know, because that can become very painful. Now, turn over to Hebrews chapter 10. It's Hebrews chapter 10. We'll pick up in verse 32, and just to take note of the fact that with the verses we're about to read here is what leads into Hebrews chapter 11, you know, which we don't normally think of as, you know, as the faith chapter. You know, it's also kind of, I like to call it the spiritual hall of fame, you know, because it kind of mentions all of, you know, the great heroes of faith, you know, that faithfully followed God. But notice that the verses that lead up to addressing that subject start in verse 32. "But recall the former days in which, after you were illuminated, you endured a great struggle with sufferings, partly while you were made a spectacle both of reproaches and tribulations, and partly while you became companions of those who were so treated. For you had compassion on me and my chains, and joyfully accepted the plundering of your goods. knowing that you have a better and enduring possession for yourselves in heaven. Therefore, do not cast away your confidence, which has great reward. For you have need of endurance, so that after you have done the will of God, you may receive the promise. Notice we receive the promise after we've successfully endured through the pain, you know, and after we've successfully suffered through it. In verse 37, for yet a little while, and he who is coming will come and will not tarry. For now the just shall live by faith. But if anyone draws back, my soul has no pleasure in him. But we are not of those who draw back to perdition, but of those who believe to the saving of the soul. So notice that the faith, you know, the just have to live by faith. Because again, it requires that faith and that trust in God, relying upon Him for His strength to be able to successfully endure, you know, to make it through all the pain and the tests and the trials that we go through. But notice, you know, he talks about those who draw back, you know, to their perdition, to their destruction. I mean, just think back through your Christian life, all the people that you've known, you know, who came into the church, who seemed to, you know, be faithfully going along for maybe even decades, and then later just abandon everything, you know, that they believed in, turn their back on it all, and now are not even attempting to follow, you know, anything that they said they believed in. They made a covenant with God, you know, with the ultimate promise of being the kingdom of God, said that they would endure to the end to receive it. But what happened before they got to the end? You know, they lost faith, they draw back, and they lost out. Well, we can see an example of this with ancient Israel. You know, fortunately, in their case, they just lost the physical promised land, you know, and not just, you know, their salvation. But we can learn a great lesson from this. Turn over to Numbers chapter 13. Numbers chapter 13. And this is when, you know, the Israelites get all the way up to the edge of the promised land, you know, and they decide, you know, kind of like any military invasion, you kind of do some reconnaissance first and, you know, check out the land and spy out and see what you're about to take on. But I think it's important to realize in this case that God had already promised them an outcome. You know, we can be in situations in our Christian life where, you know, it's something where, you know, we'd like to see, you know, something particularly work out for us or something, but we don't always know what God's will is. You know, we have to trust in God's will to working out for our best interest. But there are a lot of times in situations where we may go into something, we don't know exactly how this is going to end. You know, well, in their case, God had promised them, you know, you faithfully follow me, I'm going to give you this land. You know, you're going to be able to defeat your enemies. It's all going to work out well for you. I mean, they've been told they're going to have a positive outcome. You know, so it's not even really a question of wondering what the outcome is going to be. It's just simply trusting in God to bring it about. You know, but notice what happens here. Because in spite of all the miracles that they've experienced, I mean, they've watched a sea being parted. You know, they have watched, you know, all the plagues upon the Egyptians. And remember, even at this point, food is falling from the sky 6 days a week. Every day when they eat, they're witnessing supernatural miracles that God is taking care of them. You know, but notice that their whole focus is on what's physically around them, and there's no trust and faith in God. And what do? They draw back. You know, because they've made a covenant with God, and what's their reward? Because, you know, in their case, it's a physical covenant, and inheriting the promised land and, you know, having this great physical life, that's the reward for them. You know, but instead of charging forward in faith, you know, with God to receive that, they draw back and they lose it. So let's start here in verse 21. It's in Numbers 13. So they went up and spied out the land from the wilderness of Zin, as far as is Rehob, near the entrance of Hamath. And they went through the south and came to Hebron, and Ahiman, Shisha, and Telami, and the descendants of Anak, were there. Now, Hebron was built 7 years before Zoan in Egypt. Then they came to the valley of Eshcol, and there cut down a branch with one cluster of grapes, and they carried it between the two of them on a pole. And they also brought some of the pomegranates and figs. And the place was called the Valley of Eshcol because of the cluster which the men of Israel cut down there. And they returned from spying out the land after 40 days. So they departed and came back to Moses and Aaron and all the congregation of the children of Israel to the wilderness of Paran in Kadesh. And they brought back word to them, to all the congregation, and showed them the fruit of the land. And they told them and said, "We went to the land where you sent us, and it truly flows with milk and honey, and this is its fruit. Nevertheless, the people who dwell in the land are strong, and the cities are fortified and very large, and moreover, we saw the descendants of Anak there. The Amalekites dwell in the south, and the Hittites and the Jebusites and the Amorites dwell in the mountains, and the Canaanites dwell by the sea along the banks of the Jordan." Then Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, "Let us go up at once and take possession, for we are well able to overcome it." See, Caleb is looking to God because he knows God's already promised him an outcome. He's already said, "You know, if you faithfully obey and just do what I tell you to, I'm going to deliver it into your hands." And Caleb is thinking with faith, but everybody else is just thinking with their physical perceptions. In verse 31. But the men who had gone up with him said, "We are not able to go up against the people, for they are stronger than we." And they gave the children of Israel a bad report of the land which they had spied out, saying, "The land through which we have gone as spies, and the land devours its inhabitants. And all the people who saw it are in the men of great stature." And they saw the giants, the descendants of Anak, came from giants. And we were like grasshoppers in our own sight, so were we in their sight. Then all the congregation lifted up their voices and cried, and the people wept that night. And all the children of Israel murmured against Moses and Aaron and the whole congregation and said, "If only we had died in the land of Egypt, if only we had died in the wilderness. Why has Jehovah brought us up to the land to fall by the sword, and that our wives and children should become victims? Would it not be better for us to return to Egypt?" So they said to one another, "Let us select a leader and return to Egypt." Notice God's not even in the picture. You know, their whole focus is upon the physical obstacles that are there and all that they can perceive with their eyes. You know, but there's no faith in God. In spite of all of the incredible miracles that they've witnessed, and again, every time they eat, they're eating food that's falling from the sky. You know, there's evidence every single day that God is there to take care of them, but they're not focused on God. They're focused on everything physical around them. In verse 5, "And then Moses and Aaron fell on their faces, and all the assembly of the congregation of the children of Israel. And Joshua the son of Nun, the Caleb the son of Jephunneh, who was among those who had spied out the land, tore their clothes. And they spoke to all the congregation of the children of Israel, saying, 'The land we passed through to spy out is an exceedingly good land. If Jehovah delights in us, then he will bring us into his land and give it to us in a land which flows with milk and honey. Only do not rebel against Jehovah, nor fear the people of the land. For they are our bread, and their protection has departed from them, and Jehovah is with us. Do not fear them.' And all the congregation said to stone them with stones." So you can see that the whole focus of the people, it's all upon the physical. And what are they doing? They're drawing back from the covenant that they made. You know, they made a covenant with God that they would faithfully obey him and follow his instructions, and he would give them the promised land. And what have they done? They've lost their reward now, you know, because they don't have faith in him, and they've drawn back rather than faithfully following God in faith. Well, see, brethren, we can do the same thing in our spiritual lives. And we have a lot more at stake. You know, because for us, it's not just a physical reward of, you know, living in a nice land with, you know, great physical promises and such. For us, it's the kingdom of God. Our salvation is literally at stake. But we have to have that faith in God. And again, be willing to endure adversity. Be willing to endure uncertainty. You know, because one of the things that tripped them up here, which is, again, just kind of inherent to human nature, we don't really like uncertainty. What are we going to face here? Because in their case, they're looking at giants going, well, how are we going to deal with giants? You know, how are we going to deal with these issues? I don't really know. And they're not thinking, wait a minute, we're following a God here that parted an ocean. You know, he brought all the plagues upon the Egyptians. He rains down food from the sky 6 days a week. I think he's got this under control. You know, that doesn't really occur to them. You know, they're just scared because uncertainty doesn't feel good and they don't want to deal with it. Well, see, as Christians, we have to be willing to deal with uncertainty and to follow God. And again, even if that means going it alone, you know, and being the only one. Because what we're about to do is to look at a couple of examples in the Bible of, you know, some of our heroes in Hebrews 11. You know, who were those heroes of faith? But notice that they had to literally go it alone because they were in environments where they were like the only people converted in their time. You know, and there was no follow the strong leader, you know, follow the culture around them and just kind of go along with the herd. That wasn't really an option. You know, so let's look at that and learn from their examples. Turn back over to Hebrews chapter 11. Look at Abraham, you know, the Bible refers to as the father of the faithful. It's Hebrews chapter 11. Start reading in verse 8. It says, by faith Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out of the place in which he would afterward receive his inheritance. And he went out not knowing where he was going. Now notice that. We're going to see that when we read the actual account in Genesis 12. He doesn't know where he's going. He's literally being told by God, pack up all your stuff, leave everything that's familiar to you, go that way, and I'll tell you when to stop. You know, so he literally just has to act upon faith and head out into the unknown, trusting that God's going to work it out somehow, you know, not knowing what's going to be next, you know, what's over the next hill, what am I headed to? I don't really know. I'm just supposed to head out and go in this direction and God will tell me when to stop. You know, that's the ultimate of dealing with uncertainty, you know, and that's what Abraham had to deal with. Then continue on here in verse 9. By faith he sojourned in the land of promise, as in a foreign country, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs of him of the same promise. For he waited for the city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. And by faith Sarah herself also received strength to conceive seed, and she bore a child when she was past the age, because she judged him faithful who had promised. In other words, Sarah was beyond menopause. It was physically impossible for her to get pregnant, but God worked it out. In verse 12, therefore from one man, in him who was good as dead, were born as many as the stars of the sky in multitude, innumerable as the sand of which is by the seashore. Now jump down to verse 17. And by faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac. He who had received the promises offered up his only begotten son, of whom he had said, in Isaac your seed will be called, according to God, who was able to raise him up, even from death, which he had also received him in a figurative sense. So notice, not only is he asked to basically abandon everything that's familiar to him and head off on a journey when he's not even really sure where he is going. You know, but he's promised that God's going to bless him and he's going to have descendants. You know, this great nation's going to descend from him. Christ is going to be one of his descendants. Well, this all requires that he has a son, you know, for any of this to come about. And as we're going to see here, he has to wait 25 years for that son to even be born. And then he's asked to go take that son out and kill him. You can imagine in the back of his mind going, how is this supposed to work? You know, I waited 25 years to have a son, and this is a requirement for any of these promises to come about. Now you want me to kill him? What? You know, you could see how his physical mind would have a hard time with this. But he had faith in this, going, okay, I'm just going to trust God. He's going to work it out somehow. I'm just going to have faith in him, and he faithfully endures through it all. This is what we have to be willing to do. Again, to face adversity and to face uncertainty. You know, even when we don't know exactly what our future looks like. Turn over to Genesis chapter 12. We'll see the actual account of where this took place. Genesis chapter 12 and verse 1. Now Jehovah had said to Abram, get out of your country, from your kindred, from your father's house, to a land which I will show you, and I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. And I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse him who curses you. And all the families of the earth shall be blessed. So Abraham departed as Jehovah had spoken to him, and Lot went with him. And Abraham was 75 years old when he departed from Haran. Now notice he's literally basically being told, pack up your stuff, head that way, I'll tell you when to stop. You know, he doesn't know where he's going. He doesn't know all the details. You know, for us as physical human beings, you know, we tend to go like, no, I kind of want to know the details. I kind of want to know what to expect. I kind of want to know where I'm going to sleep, what I'm going to eat, you know, where am I going to stay? You know, how's all this going to work out? Well, God says, I'll fill you in when you get there. You know, so he's just got to have faith in God and go, okay, I'm going to follow along and God's going to work it out somehow. You know, well, you know, I'm sure when he took off initially and he's been made all these promises, he's not thinking it's going to be 25 years before I even have a son that could even be a possibility for any of this to work out. Because, you know, we won't cover this part of the story today, but, you know, there was a point where even him and Sarah both start doubting, going, you know, she's past menopause now. How is any of this supposed to work? You know, and they even had their moments of doubting. You know, well, he's 75 years old when this happens. He's 100 when Isaac is born. He has to wait 25 years, you know, for this son to be born. You know, he has to have a lot of patience and endurance. He has to wait on Jehovah, as the Bible tells us numerous times. Wait on the Lord. He has to wait on him and just have patience and go, God's going to work it out in his time, and I've just got to trust him and endure and be faithful and wait for him to tell me when it's time for it to happen. You know, because I have to bend to his will. It's not my will be done, it's his will be done. You know, and he has to live like that. Well, even after all of this happens, he finally gets a son that all this can be fulfilled to, and then God throws the absolute curveball at him and says, now I want you to take that son, take him to the mountain, and kill him for me. Now turn over to Genesis chapter 22, and we'll read this story. This is the ultimate story of just having faith in God. Because I'm sure in the back of his mind, he's wondering, how is this going to work out? You know, in addition to those issues, it just think of how emotionally grueling this has got to be for a father who waited 25 years to have this kid, who has raised him now. You know, we don't know exactly what Isaac's age is here, you know, but just from, you know, Isaac carrying the wood and the other things involved here, he's probably at least a teenager. You know, by the time this is taking place. But just imagine the emotional turmoil this has got to put a father through of, you mean, I've got to kill him? You know, I mean, this has got to be just a brutally, you know, trial for him to go through. This is Genesis 22 and verse 1. Now it came to pass after these things that God tested Abraham and said to him, Abraham, and he said, here I am. And he said, take now your son, your only son, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah, and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I shall tell you. So Abraham rose early in the morning and saddled his donkey, and took two of the young men with him, and Isaac his son, and he split the wood for a burnt offering, and rose and went to the place in which God had told him. And on the third day Abraham lifted his eyes and saw the place afar off. And Abraham said to his young men, stay here with the donkey. The lad and I will go yonder and worship, and he will come back to you. So Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on Isaac, his son. And he took the fire in his hand and a knife, and the two of them and went together. So Isaac spoke to Abraham, his father, and said to him, "Here I am, my son." And he said, "Look, the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for a burnt offering?" And Abraham said, "My son, God will provide for him the lamb for a burnt offering." And the two of them went together. Now just imagine emotionally what that was like for Abraham. You know, knowing what he's been asked to do, and now his son is asking him, you know, "Where is the sacrifice?" And imagine the lump in his throat when he's responding to his son. You know, the emotional turmoil this has got to put this man through. In verse 9, "And they came to the place of which God had told him. And Abraham built an altar there and placed the wood in order. And he bound Isaac his son and laid him on the altar upon the wood. And Abraham stretched out his hand and took the knife to slay his son. But the angel of Jehovah called to him by heaven and said, 'Abraham, Abraham.' And he said, 'Here I am.' And he said, 'Do not lay your hand on the lad or anything to him. For now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me.' And Abraham lifted his eyes and looked, and there behind him was a ram caught in the thicket by its horns. So Abraham went and took the ram and offered it up for a burnt offering instead of his son." Now, as we read from Hebrews 11, it tells us there that, you know, that Abraham, you know, basically concluded that, you know, if need be, God can resurrect him. You know, so he doesn't know that God's going to stop him at the last minute, and he's not going to have to go through, you know, with something he doesn't want to have to do here, which is killing his own son. He's just having to trust God that God's going to work it out somehow. So you can imagine how painful this was. But notice, as he's going through all of this, you know, in Abraham's time, no one else is converted at this time. He doesn't get to follow, you know, a physical leader. He doesn't get to kind of go along with the structure around him. He has to go it alone. He has to trust in God and to obey him in spite of everything else around him. You know, I'm sure it was a lonely situation for him to deal with, but again, that's what you're called to do. We're called to be salmon going upstream, you know, and to faithfully obey God, even again when that's difficult, even if we have to go it alone. Even if we're going against all the social structure around us, we can't just be the one that wants to kind of follow the herd and do what's comfortable. Well, another great example of this is Joseph. And I think there's a number of things in Joseph's situation that are just really noteworthy to me. You know, one is the fact of how young he is, you know, when he receives, you know, these dreams. Because, you know, when Joseph is 17 years old, God gives him a couple of dreams and basically reveals to him that, you know, his brothers are going to bow down to him. You know, his you know, his father, his mother, his, you know, all of his siblings are going to bow down to him ultimately. Well, you know, typical 17-year-old kid, he goes and brags about it to the rest of the family. You know, which wasn't a real smart move to do, but that's, you know, that's typical of what a 17-year-old boy would do, is go and brag about it. Well, just imagine from his point of view, from expectations, I'm sure he's imagining, "Hey, I'm going to be a big shot. Everything's going to work out great, great for me," and all this. He's not imagining, "No, I'm going to be thrown in a well. I'm going to be sold off into slavery. You know, I'm going to wind up over, you know, at Potiphar's house and be set up with false rape allegations and then thrown in prison. And this is going to go on for 13 years, you know, before life ever even gets better for me. And it's going to be 22 years, you know, from the time I received this dream before any of this gets fulfilled." But what's amazing to me about this situation is not only is he faithful all of this, if Joseph ever cops an attitude, if he ever loses faith in God through all of this, or just cops an attitude for how nothing has gone the way he would anticipate it to go, the Bible doesn't record anything to indicate that that's the case. You know, because it you know, it records him kind of shooting his mouth off and, you know, bragging to his brothers about how he's going to be a big shot and everyone's going to bow down to him. Well, then he gets thrown into a well, he gets sold into slavery, but he's faithful through all of this. in Potiphar's house and in prison, through all of this, never once again, at least according to what's recorded, does he ever cop an attitude and get mad at God for treating him like this. Because turn over to chapter 39 here. And we're kind of skip through for time's sake the whole story of his dream and being thrown in the well. I think we're all kind of familiar with that. But as you can imagine, this doesn't turn out at all as he would have anticipated. You know, because he has a dream, they're all going to bow down to him. I'm sure he's thinking, I'm just going straight to the top and great, you know, straight to prestige and honor. And that is not what happens. You know, in fact, he is faithful to God and he gets punished for it, is basically what happens. And start reading here in verse, you know, chapter 39 in verse 1. Now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard, an Egyptian, brought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there. And Jehovah was with Joseph, and he was successful, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. And his master saw that Jehovah was with him, and that Jehovah had made all that he did to prosper in his hand. So Joseph found favor in his sight and served him. And then he made him overseer of his house and all that he put in his hand. So it was from the time that he made him overseer of his house and all that he had that Jehovah blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. And the blessing of Jehovah was on all that he had in the house and in the field. And he left all that he had in Joseph's hand, and he did not know that he had except for the bread that he ate. And Joseph was handsome in form and in appearance. Now it came to pass after these things that his master's wife came casting longing eyes on Joseph, and she said, "Lie with me." But he refused and said to his master's wife, "Look, my master does not know what is with me in the house, and he has committed all that he has in my hand. And there is no one greater in this house than I, nor has he kept back anything from me because you are his wife. And how then do I get this great wickedness and sin against God?" For it was that she spoke to Joseph day by day, and he did not heed her, and he to lie with her or to be with her. But it happened about this time when Joseph went into the house to do his work, and none of the men of the house was inside, that she caught him by the garment, saying, "Lie with me." But he left his garment in her hand and fled and ran outside. And so it was when she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and fled outside, that she called him to the men of the house and spoke to them, saying, "See, he has brought in us a Hebrew to mock us. And he came in to lie with me, and I cried out with a loud voice. It happened when he heard and lifted my voice and cried out, he left his garment with me and fled and went outside. So he kept his garment with her until his master came home. And then he spoke with him the words like these, saying, "The Hebrew servant from whom you brought to us came in to me to mock me. So it happened, I lifted my voice and cried out, and he left in his garment with me and fled outside." So it was that his master heard the words which his wife had spoke to him, saying, "Your servant did to me after this manner," and his anger was aroused. And then Joseph's master took him and put him in the prison, in the place where the king's prisoners were confined. And he was there in prison. But Jehovah was with Joseph and showed him mercy. And he gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. Now the keeper of the prison committed to Joseph's hands all the prisoners who were in the prison. And whatever they did there, it was his doing. And the keeper of the prison did not look into anything, but was under Joseph's hand, because Jehovah with him whatever he did, and Jehovah made it prosper. Now, if you notice through all of this, you know, for first of all, just to be humorous about this, if we put this in modern day context, what happened to Joseph is he got what we would call today Me Too'd. You know, it's basically, you're familiar with kind of the Me Too movement. You know, where it turned into not only, you know, taking serious, you know, allegations of sexual abuse or rape, but it became believe all women. You know, any allegation made by a woman, you automatically have to believe it without evidence. Well, that's basically what happened to Joseph here. He didn't do anything wrong. You know, basically he rejected the advances of a woman coming after him, and then she punished him, you know, for rejecting her by fake, you know, rape allegations, and got him thrown in prison. You know, so basically Joseph was a completely honorable guy the whole time, and he gets punished for it. You know, but if you think about through Joseph's life, it wasn't real wise for him to be bragging in front of his brothers, you know, of how they were going to bow down to him. But he was honestly just conveying that God had given him a dream, and he believed God, you know, that he was going to truly do this. So, I mean, he's being obedient to him here. He's being obedient, you know, when he's tempted by Potiphar's wife as well. And consistently, he's getting punished, you know, for doing what's right, because, you know, from a physical perspective, from his point of view, things just keep going wrong. You know, he's thrown into a well, he's thrown into prison, he keeps getting punished. He's an honorable guy who's faithfully obeying God the whole time, and everything just keeps going wrong, you know, and he keeps being punished. Well, I mean, he's an incredible, you know, example of faith. Because again, if he wanted to just look at the physical circumstances and the pain that he's going through, you can totally understand this guy copping an attitude. You know, if I was faithful to God, he gives me this dream, I just told the truth about it, and I got sold into slavery. And then I got tempted to commit adultery with my owner's wife, and I did the right thing and I rejected it. And I got thrown in prison for it, you know. And this goes on for 13 years, you know, before he's finally given out and then given a position of honor. Talk about an example of faith, because he has to believe in God and trust in him through this whole time. And he doesn't have a social structure around him, you know, some positive peer pressure going in the right direction. No, everything's going the opposite. And he has to trust in God and just have faith in him and endure regardless of what's happening around him. And see, that's the example that we all have to follow, because that's the covenant we made at baptism, is that we would obey God regardless of the circumstances. And if that meant forsaking everything else around us, forsaking, you know, the social structure, even potentially losing our own lives, that's what we agreed to. Because that's what it requires to follow God. We have to have that faith in him. So to bring this to a conclusion, turn back to Hebrews chapter 11. Let's notice in particular that the latter part of the chapter, because oftentimes we love to focus on the earlier parts of the chapter because it's all the nice feel-good stories that we like to focus on. All the people who believed in God, and you know, God just worked everything out for them and performed miracles, and they were protected and delivered from the pain, and everything turned out well. Well, we also need to pay attention to the end of the chapter as well, because it gives us all the examples of the people who got tortured and killed and who died doing what was right, and their ultimate reward's going to be, you know, in the resurrection, but it wasn't in this physical life. Pick up in verse 35 in Hebrews chapter 11. So the women received their dead raised to life again, and others were tortured, not accepting deliverance that they might obtain a better resurrection. Still others had trials of mockings, scourgings, yes, of chains and imprisonment. And they were stoned and they were sawn in two, were tempted, were slain with a sword. They wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, tormented, of whom the world was not worthy. They wandered in deserts and mountains, in dens and in caves of the earth. All these, having obtained a good testimony through faith, did not receive the promise, God having provided something better for us, that they should not be made perfect apart from us. See, they were looking to New Jerusalem. You know, as it says of Abraham, you know, he looked to that city whose builder and maker is God. They were looking to the ultimate reward of salvation, of being made as a God being and being born into the kingdom. And that's what we have to do in our physical lives. It's having faith in God and trusting in him to work it out. Again, even if that's a Joseph experience, you know, where you just have to endure and do, you know, you're the only one, you're by yourself, and you even get punished for doing what's right, you know, and every time you think things are going to turn out, you have to wait a little longer, you know, but ultimately it worked out. You know, it took 22 years, but eventually his brothers did bow down before him, and the promises he was giving did happen. And the same will work out for us. If we faithfully endure God, we'll be rewarded with the kingdom of God. But we have to remember, as we're on this spiritual journey, it's our physical, you know, tendency as physical human beings. And we can see, going back to Mount Sinai forward, mankind has always had a tendency We want to follow a strong leader. We want to follow the social structure around us. We want to kind of go along with the stream, follow the herd. Well, that's not the commitment we made at baptism. The commitment we made at baptism is we would follow God, that we were making a covenant with Him, and we would follow Him regardless of what that meant. And again, we're willing to put Him above everything else in our lives. And again, even if that means up giving our own lives. So brethren, as we go forward from this Sabbath, let's make sure that we're looking to God and that we're developing the faith to follow God.